Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And we're talking just a couple of days before the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, 5782, right? That's the number.
That's it.
Starting on Monday night, us Jews around the world will sit down, dip our apples in honey. Did you see Manim, Lahav?
We do.
Right, with all
we
the...
only started doing it when we made Aliyah.
So same here in my family. So that's almost 30 years now. But we do, there's all the green stuff, and I don't know what the gourd. Is there something called gourd, right?
You use all of these, like...
lentils and weird vegetables that you never eat during the year.
Names in Aramaic, and then you tell puns based on their names in Arabic. So, like, black-eyed peas are called, like, rubia, I think. And then it's
rubia,
like... Yeah, and then it's like, she'irbuz chuyotenu, that we shall have a lot of merit this year, things like that.
And gezer is gzar dinenu, right?
Right.
Like, to rip up the evil decrees or something like that against us. It's cute, it's fun.
I have Israeli relatives who made one up where they have raisins and celery to raise our salary.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. But if there's really, that's in English. So.
Right. Well, they're like raisins and celery.
Ah, so they say it with an accent. Fantastic. So Rosh Hashanah is coming up, and it's a great time to look back and think about the year that was and look towards to the year that will be. And what I was thinking about as we contemplated what we would talk about in this podcast, and we'll have two conversations. One will be with Jeremy Sharon, who is our religious affairs correspondent, kind of looking at the way prayer, observance, worship, Jewish ritual has changed over the last year from one Rosh Hashanah to the next under the cloud and shadow of the COVID-19 pandemic, and talk about prayer services. I'll be praying outside in my backyard again, once again. And then we'll talk with Steve Lindy to mark the 20th year anniversary of 9/11. Steve, who is the former editor of the Jerusalem Post and current editor of our magazine, Jerusalem Report, was night editor the night of September 11th here at the Jerusalem Post, and can speak about his experience that night. And you have a wonderful story yourself, Lahav, of where you were on your second day of high school in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Right, with your mother, who was heading to the World Trade Center. So we'll get to that a bit later. But I was thinking, if you just look at the news over the last couple of days, so Khan al-Ahmar, which kind of sounds out there, but that's that Bedouin village just near Kfar Adumim. Bennett's government has again said, we want a 6-month delay. There was the soldier Bar El Shmueli, who was shot tragically along the border with Gaza and has sparked this political fight where the IDF is now a political football again, and bereaved families and takedown of politicians over what happened. The change government seems like the same government. Right. All this hope and that we thought of things that would change. And it taps into something that, and maybe this is how it connects to Rosh Hashanah, is that we always try to think that things are going to change. But I sometimes have this feeling, maybe I've been doing this for too long, of how the stories are the same. You just change the names and they're different names.
Yeah. I mean, look, this government is very different in the way it looks very different. It would be very hard for them to just change everything right away. And when it comes to specific things you mentioned, like Khan al-Ahmar, is a huge international controversy. The original court order for it to be demolished was several years ago, and Netanyahu, in the end, didn't demolish it because Angela Merkel was visiting Israel, and she basically was like, I'm not going to come if you do that. And so he was like, okay, we'll postpone it. And now it's just been postponed every 6 months for, ad infinitum. But these are the kinds of things where these problems will remain for the new government. It might not be Merkel because she's leaving office, but if they demolish it, it'll be a huge controversy. And then, unlike Netanyahu, this government has the added issue of within their government, it'll be a huge controversy. Ra'am, the Arab party that's in this coalition, actually is the major political representative of Bedouins. Now, the Bedouins of Khan al-Ahmar are Palestinians, but it's still, they're not going to like it. Meretz won't like it. Not entirely sure how Labor feels. And just all of these problems they're the same problems.
It's the same problem, but that's the same problem that Netanyahu had.
Right. Anybody who thinks that, they have magical solutions for our problems is lying to you.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, you look at the Palestinian, the wider conflict, right? It's not as if Bennett's now in office and saying, okay, I have some magical wand that I can wave and it'll make everything go away and be different. It's this, we're talking about the same issues and it's the same conversations.
You know, what I thought of recently about Bennett, which is interesting, is that he keeps talking about, well, you know, this government, we can't really do anything because it has, you know, different sides of the political spectrum. We don't agree. So we're just going to keep the Palestinian issue sort of on a low flame and like keep the status quo. But when he entered politics, one of his like, things that he kept saying was that if we try to like minimize the Palestinian issue as much as possible, like we have so many other things to offer the world and to talk to the world about, maybe we just shouldn't focus on the Palestinians so much. So I was starting to think that maybe it's not just because of this coalition. Like this is what Bennett has thought all along is the right thing to do, which is very similar to Netanyahu, by the way.
By the way, I think you can make an argument in the other direction is that because you have such a diverse government that is so broad and so representative, unprecedented a representation of the Israeli people, right? You don't have the Haredim in the government, the ultra-Orthodox, but you have the Arabs and the left and the right and the religious, is actually the moment in time to do something on the Palestinian issue because you have such a wide consensus, right? This is where most Israelis, at the end of the day, from Bennett, who's very right-wing, at least he was before he became prime minister, but I still think he is, to the people on the left, all agree on one main principle. We need to find a way to separate from the Palestinian people, right? Bennett's vision of that is to do it in a way that we annex Area C, but we don't annex Areas A and B. We don't give them a state, but we give them autonomy on steroids, all these things that are, so it's almost a state, but it's not a state. That's just semantic games, right? The left wingers, of course, want to give them a state, and right there they might disagree. They want more than just areas A and B, but the principle is the same. So if we all agree on the same principle, maybe now is actually the opportunity to do something in a way that would have such a broad consensus. But unfortunately, they're going to use the broad consensus as the excuse not to do something.
Well, and I also don't think that the there is no partner problem, which is I don't think that Abbas wants to do anything right now either. I mean,
I'm not saying that there is an opportunity. I'm not saying that Mahmoud Abbas is the perfect peace partner. What I'm saying, and maybe I'll just clarify, is that we have to decide what we want to do. And I feel that, you know, on this eve of Rosh Hashanah is also an opportunity to reflect. But it's that a feeling that I've had for a long time and definitely in the last few years is that we don't make the decision of what we want to do. What do we really want with the Palestinians? That's up to us to decide. It's not if we just wait around. So the Biden administration will come and say, this is what you need to do. And that's what happened. The Trump administration put out a peace plan. The Obama administration put out a peace plan. The George W. Bush administration put out a peace plan. The Clinton administration, but everyone puts out a peace plan. But where's the Israeli peace plan? And instead of us just waiting for someone else to tell us what to do, we should be deciding for ourselves. It has to do with the West Bank. It has to do with Gaza. It has to do with what we want in terms of Haredim and their integration into Israeli society. There's so many issues that we just don't want to decide because it's complicated. It's better not to decide.
Yeah, no, and it's true. And this government, just like Netanyahu, on all the issues you just mentioned, is just being reactive instead of proactive. And it's interesting because we actually have a prime minister now who has a peace plan. I mean, he wrote it like 10 years ago, and there's a YouTube video with these very clever little cartoons.
Hands, right? And like hands.
Yeah, it's a good YouTube video. But that's not what he's doing. So, I mean, maybe next year, not necessarily with the Palestinians, but in general, the hope our government will be a little bit more proactive for the good of Israel instead of just putting out fires.
So looking back, Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah, Lahav, you've recently moved. You left the big city of Tel Aviv.
Yes, for the boring suburbs.
For the suburbs. How's this Rosh Hashanah going to be different for your family?
Honestly, it's not because I'm not even going to be home. I'm going to my in-laws. we're still unpacking. We're still getting used to the move. My kids are in new preschools. And so it's a lot of adjustments.
So far, knock on wood, bli ayin hara, no quarantine, no bidud yet for the kids.
Yes, they've had 3 days of preschool. Today's the fourth. So let's hope.
The fourth. Okay, my kids, my younger two, have been in school 3 days as well. Today's the fourth day as
right.
well.
Older kids don't have Fridays, right?
My elementary kids still do, right? But my ninth grader, for example, does not. So they're also in school. So far, so good. We hope it stays that way. We'll be, like I said before, outside, davening and praying, putting together a minyan. Should be interesting once again. But this year, the Jerusalem municipality threw in these kind of shade covers, and they gave them away to people that you can put up and make shade in your backyard if you're having a service down there. But I think that, you know, overall, I think we're in a better place, right? You know, in terms of the vaccines, I've gotten my third shot, right? You've gotten...
Yes, I got mine too.
You got your third shot. We got the booster, so we're all boosted up. And hopefully that's what will keep us safe for the next few months.
Yeah, and if we're lucky, then in the next year, the pandemic will die down. I mean, I don't think COVID is going away, but maybe it'll reach a more livable level.
Right. Well, to all our listeners, we started this podcast, as you know, just a few months ago. It's been fun. We're continuing. And we want to wish all of you a Shana Tova, happy, and probably most importantly, healthy new year for the coming year. Shana Tova. Jeremy Sharon, the Jerusalem Post religious affairs correspondent. Great to have you on the podcast. So we wanted to talk to you a bit about how the pandemic has changed religious life for Jews, for Israelis, of course, as well. And looking back from one Rosh Hashanah to the next, what has changed if you kind of look at it in broad strokes, right? Prayer is still the same. Services are still the same. Maybe a little different, right? You get to make it shorter if you're praying outside. Right? You get to start a little earlier or later. I don't know.
I see the pleasure that gives you.
Yeah, that gives me a ton of pleasure. You have no idea. So not only can I come late, but I can also, there's less to say. But how does it look for religious life in Israel?
I think firstly, it depends what kind of Jews we're talking about. Haredi Jews, modern Orthodox Jews, traditional Jews. And I think the changes will be different for different groups. I think to a large extent, the ultra-Orthodox communities do things very similar. I just saw a picture of the massive hall of the Vizhnitz Hasidic group being prepared for Rosh Hashanah just now.
And let me guess, all vaccinated, only green pass, you had to have the third booster, and you all have to wear a mask when inside, and social distance, right?
They'll pay a non-Jew to check your green pass.
Right.
So not exactly. They, you know... I don't know how many people the hall holds, 5,000, let's say. It's massive. But on the other hand, a lot of the ultra-Orthodox have had the vaccination. A lot of them have had the third booster. The vaccination rates do lag behind some of the general population, but then they've also had higher infection rates. So
herd immunity.
No, but they're actually really far from herd immunity because they tested a lot of the children and they found that it's only like 20% had COVID.
Yeah, I mean
20% among Haredim, among
Haredi children.
In the regular general population, it's much less.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Some places were higher, like Beit Arilit had 33% the children were infected. But yeah, they don't have herd infection just from infection rates. Anyway, I think the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, will continue to do things pretty much similar to as they've done them. But I think like from our communities, we know the modern Orthodox communities, they're more, there's people praying outside. There's a lot of social distancing inside synagogues. And I think, to a certain extent, some of the prayer services are shortened.
Do you feel, Jeremy, though, that on a more theological level, if that's the right term, people are looking at this pandemic as this magefa, mm-hmm. right? The plague. And does it question faith? Does it raise questions of existential significance for Jews? Is there a debate, or do Haredim, does like the ultra-Orthodox's literature, does it talk about this at all?
Whenever kind of a travesty comes along, the rabbis always say, well, they kind of do try and ask what's happening, but then they say, well, we have to strengthen ourselves in our faith, in our prayer, in our Torah study. That's the general approach of the ultra-Orthodox. I don't know if there's that kind of introspection beyond that, but I think, like I said, you know, when the ultra-Orthodox have a travesty, like, I don't know if there's a terrorist attack, or they kind of don't look at the immediate actual reasoning. Even just now, the Meron disaster, the grand rabbi of the Toldos Aron Hasidic community said, we just have to be better Jews. We don't even need to actually find, it's not even important to find out specifically what happened and what went wrong. We just have to be better Jews.
Right.
And if we're better Jews,
and still
then,
bring hundreds of thousands of people to a place that can only accommodate 5,000 people.
If we're better Jews, then God will not visit these disasters on us.
Although we brought a Haredi woman onto the show, Tzipi Yalom Dayan, who writes for Mishpacha magazine, and she has a completely opposite attitude of, no, there must be an investigation.
Would you say she's a more modern Haredi?
Yes.
She is more modern.
Her name appears in a newspaper.
Right, okay. So, yeah. Right. So, I mean, again, it depends on listen, there's lots of Haredim, especially, there's lots of Haredim, I think, especially the more modern stream of the ultra-Orthodox community, who definitely were appalled by the fact that the ultra-Orthodox parties didn't want to look into what happened here. Well, absolutely.
It ties kind of in, because when you look at this last year, mm-hmm. right, so you mentioned, you know, maybe, if we don't know, but maybe some sort of herd immunity right now in the Vizhnitz courtyard or chatzer, whatever they call it, of the Hasidim, and therefore they can have so many people who come and not worry so much about infections. I don't know if that's real or not, but you have that. And on the other hand, you also have the high infection rate that came, and that's what led to maybe this herd immunity. So many people were killed and died in the Haredi community, plus Meron, right? They've been struck by tragedy after tragedy over the last year, and that's not a wake-up call?
For a lot, no. For some, yes. Like, for instance, there was the grand rabbi of the Slonim Hasidim, and he was very stringent during the whole of the COVID crisis with the restrictions, and, you know, he insisted on people wearing masks, and when the vaccines came along, he insisted on people getting vaccinated. He was very stringent. And there was another rabbi, he's actually originally American, called Rav Asher Weiss, and he was also very stringent about all the COVID regulations. And then both of those rabbis were actually publicly critical of the lack of respect for the regulations by large parts of the ultra-Orthodox community. So, I mean, I think, like Lahav says, there's always different groups within groups who have different perspectives. But I said, like I said, I think the kind of the general spiritual, the mainstream spiritual leadership, like Rabbi Kanievsky and Rabbi Edelstein and so on.
Young men.
right. Rabbi Edelstein is 96, I think, and Rabbi Kanievsky is 99, between 90 or 92. But Rav Kanievsky himself had COVID, let's not forget.
Right.
Rav Edelstein was very strict about the COVID regulations himself.
Rav Edelstein was the one who was always in
behind the glass.
Was a glass or plastic, and yeah. Rav Kanievsky was meeting people.
Yeah.
With no masks or anything.
Exactly, which is probably why he got COVID.
Right. Maybe.
Right. But in general, like I said, the message is more
spiritual, we have to work on ourselves.
Exactly. But the message of being careful about the pandemic did get deeper into the messaging of the senior rabbinic leadership as the pandemic has gone on, and both Rabbi Kanievsky and Rabbi Edelstein have said you have to go and get vaccinated.
Right, and they also said the teachers have to get vaccinated. When last time in the beginning of the pandemic, they refused to shut down the schools.
And Rabbi Kanievsky just now said if a teacher's not vaccinated, then get rid of her.
Right.
I'm reminded, and I think a lot of people forget, that just like a year and a half before the COVID pandemic, there was a measles outbreak in Israel. And many people sort of sourced it to the Haredi community. A lot of people coming from Uman, which is where there's a Rabbi Nachon's grave in Ukraine. But then when people really dug down and looked into it, the vaccination rates in the Haredi community against measles was actually higher than the general population of the country. And so there is a culture among Haredim of, you know, following medical advice. You know, we're not doctors. The doctors know what to do. And then, you know, v'nishmaltem nafshachem, like, you should protect your life very much. But then I think that the difference here is that it's the social distancing. It's that it's not just go get vaccinated and not just go to the doctor to help you. It's that this could keep you away from school. This could keep you away from synagogue. And that's like the inherent tension there.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole problem of COVID in the ultra-Orthodox community was the challenge to the ultra-Orthodox way of life. Public prayer, going to yeshiva, going to school, communal gatherings for all types of Jewish life. That was definitely, you know, the major challenge, and the challenge which the rabbis had a hard time, you know, kind of coming to terms with. I think often lifestyle issues play a part of this. Yaakov, remember when there was that measles outbreak here, and I spoke to this
Haredi
Haredi rabbi, like like the hardcore, the hardest of the hardcore.
Todos are owners.
I think right? Todos are of the ultra orthodox community, and he was running like a measles vaccination.
Rabbi
campaign.
Brown, Brown.
Yeah, Brown. That's it. And he was running this campaign, and he said to me, "I said to him, so why?
They must have remind me, Jeremy. They vaccinated about 20,000.
He did a massive campaign, 20,000 to 30,000
in Meir Shearim alone or something, right?
And I said to him, so why have people not got their vaccine? So he said, well, what happens is you get the first shot, I think, when the kids are still like very young, maybe is it one, and you take them to the Tipat Chalav.
Jeremy,
like
you got to freshen up on this stuff. You just had a baby. You got to get with the schedule.
Got to free up the RAM there. So they get it at 6 months, the first one, and then there's a booster about a year later. By the time there's a booster, they might already be in their childcare framework, and there might even be another kid on the way. So this guy said, who did the vaccination drive, he said, sometimes the parents just don't have a minute to go and take them to get the booster. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, it's the kind of very unique lifestyle factor.
And that unique lifestyle factor also impacts COVID because they live, you know, they have a lot of children and live in small homes. Yep. You know, a lot of them live in poverty. And so, you know, it just spreads so quickly. You can't quarantine one child away from the others when you're living 10 people in a 3-bedroom apartment.
Right. I mean, I think that's why this Chag, this holiday of Rosh Hashanah, is going to be so interesting to watch because, A, we don't have a lockdown this time. Last time we did. But also, like you mentioned, Jeremy, the Vizhinitz Hall, where thousands of people will be praying. What will that do? The kids who have just returned to school, and they'll be home now for a few days. Are they going to be infecting family members, people with grandparents? And right, we like to have big meals.
It's not just the Haredim I'm thinking about. My family, I have. We'll have kids in schools from 3 different cities at one meal.
Right, and we'll be meeting with my 2 brothers. Will be coming to us for one of the meals. And I mean, my kids have been back to school. Who's going to be infecting who, God forbid? So I think we're going to see a lot of what's going to happen. But on the other hand, it's nice to have a holiday where we are able to celebrate.
Absolutely. But I think one of the things which, you know, you said, what has changed, and maybe perhaps a bit less in Israel, but definitely outside of Israel, you know, you've got this whole idea of, especially in the non-Orthodox communities of, you know, live stream services, where there's also, you can participate from home. There's a lot of programming which is done now online, and some communities are doing a mixture. You can go in person, and if there's not enough space, then you can participate online. And also, even the Orthodox communities, I was talking to Rabbi Moshe Howe of the Orthodox Union, and he said that a lot of their services are going to be moving outdoors or into smaller venues. And he said that, you know, he said something interesting to me. He said a lot of people like the fact that during COVID prayer services have been smaller because it's been more intimate, and everyone gets to do, more people get to do something to lead the services to.
They've also been a little faster, which I feel is highly
come
valuable.
Back to the speed again.
Yes.
You have good weather. I mean, I guess it depends where you are in the US, but where I grew up in the Northeast, it's like really good weather this time of year too. It's
right.
Like much here, it's super hot, but I think like to do an outdoor minion for Rosh Hashanah in New Jersey, it would probably be good right now.
Right.
Right. Not sure about down south in Florida.
I don't know. New Jersey right now after Hurricane Ida.
The hurricane is bad.
Right.
That's true. This
you don't
is
get
also
washed
when we
away
get
in the middle of Netanya Tokef.
Right.
Which might fit into the Netanya Tokef theme, actually.
Between plagues and floods.
Correct.
And fire.
Well, Jeremy, thanks for coming in and sharing with us your thoughts about the Rosh Hashanah celebrations this year around. And Shana Tova to you and your family.
Shana Tova.
There is a major incident in Lower Manhattan.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, God.
There's another one.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. There is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a difficult moment for America.
So this Saturday, we're going to be marking 20 years since the attack on the Twin Towers. And here to talk to us about what it was like putting together the Jerusalem Post for September 12th is Steve Lindy, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Report, who was night editor on September 11th, 2001.
Thank you. Yeah, it was when the attack happened, it was sort of in the afternoon, late afternoon Israel time. I was on my way to work. I remember calling my dad and saying, you have to turn on the TV. Something terrible has happened. And I got to work and I realized that this was going to be a night no one was ever going to forget. And of course, we scrambled to get as much material as we could from New York and from all our correspondents. And we prepared a really bumper page one with a picture from Reuters of the planes going into the Twin Towers. And then I got a call from the publisher, who happened to be in New York, saying, don't put that picture on page one. Put a picture of Palestinians celebrating instead. And I said, but every paper in the world is going to have this picture on the front page. And he said, yes, but that's what will make us different. That's what will make the Jerusalem Post different. And I didn't listen, and we did go with a picture of the planes going into the towers, and I thought I was going to be fired the next day, but I wasn't, and I went on to be editor. But yeah, that was one of the most stressful nights I think I've ever had in my life.
And it was in a really stressful period. I mean, it was in the middle of the Second Intifada. I'm sure you were covering terrorist attacks all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing quite prepares you for 9/11.
Right.
We really didn't know what to do. We called our New York correspondent, who I won't mention her name, but she basically said that she's too stressed to write the story and that I should take it from the wires, which we ended up doing. You'll see there's an AP story on the front page.
Steve, the what point, I mean, I guess when you're night editor, you're kind of like the producer of the newspaper, right? So you're getting stories, you got to lay things out, you got to make sure you got the right photos, the captions, the stories are coming in, everything's set up, you got to lay it out on the page. So there's a lot of different moving pieces and a lot of stress that's involved in that. But at what point did it hit you that you realized, okay, that the world is now going to change from what we knew it until the morning of September 11th on the East Coast and going forward?
You know, I think most journalists act like most people do, when there's a crisis or a trauma, you kind of get through the moment without thinking too much. And then only afterwards does it hit you. Oh, my God, that was probably the most serious event of our lifetime. And, you know, in Israel, we were used to terrorist attacks, but nothing of that scale. And it didn't really hit me until literally weeks later. And I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep for nights afterwards. But I think that when you're in a situation like that, you just want to try and get it out as much as possible. And I did what night editors are supposed to do. I called everyone. We had a major underline of all the things that happened.
And a massive photo on the front page.
And a massive photo, very little text.
It was, I mean, there are some moments that I know from the last few years of being editor, and I'm sure you do from being editor before me, is that there are some stories that you know, okay, this is not your average event, right? This requires a different layout, a different, like, you have that thought cross your mind. Now, obviously, you're in the moment and you gotta hustle, right? But that was that day, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that was a day that, you know, everybody will remember where they were on that day. And I just remember telling myself to breathe and just do the best I can. And in the end, just as we were about to send to print, and everything looked perfect and had been sent everywhere to check, we heard on the radio that there'd been an American aerial strike on Afghanistan. And the duty editor, who was above me in the totem pole, said to me, stop the press, we have to get this in. This is probably the American response to 9/11. And so we got rid of all the underlines on the page under the headline. And the little picture with the Palestinians was referred, that all went away. And it said something like, bulletin, U.S. attacks Afghanistan.
So you had to stop the press.
We literally stopped the press to put that in. And for all we knew, an American attack on Afghanistan was about to happen.
Right, which eventually did. Lahav, where were you that day?
So it was my second day of high school in Manhattan.
Ninth grade.
I was living in New Jersey and commuting into Manhattan with my mother. And it was my second day, and I had not taken the subway alone, and I was still nervous. And my mother had a meeting in the World Trade Center that day, which she was late for because she went on the subway with me. And everyone who was supposed to be in the meeting with her went out to coffee and weren't in the Twin Towers when the plane hit. So it was one of these like crazy butterfly effect stories where, like, me being a nervous child saved about 7 people.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a pretty great story. I go into it at length in this week's Jerusalem Post magazine. But basically, we couldn't get out of the city. My mom walked up to my school. She walked from basically from the World Trade Center to the Upper East Side.
So she what? She made it down there as the planes hit, or just
she got out of the subway,
right?
And she, I just talked to her last night about this because I was working on the magazine story, and she said she felt like it was like a video that someone had hit pause because everyone on the street was just looking up at the sky, like mouths open, not moving. And it was just like the first tower was smoking. And my mom's Israeli, and it was the middle of the second intifada. And her first thought, which she said out loud on the street, like talking to herself, was, it's Arab terrorists. And people looked at her and they were like, no, it was an accident. It was a, like, because it was only the first tower. And she was like, no, it's Arab terrorists. And she just did an about face and started walking away. Wow. Yeah. And yeah, so she actually walked. There was no cell phone reception. And I was the only kid from my Jewish community commuting into that school. So there was no like bus, like other kids, the buses turned around and picked them up. Cause the buses hadn't even like, they were still in the city. But I didn't have a school bus. I was with my mom. And so she walked all the way up, from the World Trade Center to the Upper East Side to pick me up. And then we were just like wandering the city for hours trying to figure out how to get out of there. In the end, we like slept at a coworker. But, you know, you were saying, Steve, about how it doesn't sink in that day. I mean, I was also 13 years old, but I did my homework that night. And my mother laughed at me. She was like, you don't have to do your homework. There's not going to be school tomorrow. But I was like, no, I have to do it. It's the first week of school. I have to do my homework. So, you know, really did not sink
in. I think, you know, the world definitely changed in a way that America obviously came to the Middle East in a massive way that it hadn't been prior. Israel, I remember that at the time, Israel tried to kind of take advantage, right, to an extent. Not in a necessarily bad way, Steve, right? But remind me, like, Ariel Sharon, who was then the prime minister, definitely tried to, there was a lot of sympathy and solidarity with the United States. But it was also, there were Israeli voices at the time that were saying, okay, now America understands what we're going through, right? And maybe we'll get a little more sympathy because we were at the time, right? This is 2001. You know, just what is it? 6-7 months later is the Park Hotel bombing, right, on the night of Passover, right? So America's just embarking on in the war in Afghanistan, is still a bit away from the war in Iraq, but we're still having suicide bus attacks and cafe attacks and bombing attacks all over the place, right?
Yeah, I think that's you described it exactly right. I mean, that was the feeling in Israel. I remember a number of people, including the prime minister, saying it, that now they'll understand what we go through every day. And, you know, as a journalist covering these suicide bombings and the Intifada, you do also feel, wow, what would it have been like to be there? You know, it's hard enough to cover a bloody suicide bombing in Jerusalem, but with so many people, you know, dead and injured, how do you do that? And I remember thinking at the time, yes, maybe they get it, but maybe we don't get the scale of the attack that just happened. And you can't really compare the two.
But when you look back, I'm just curious, after the last 20 years now, right? So it's, I mean, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. 20 years ago, the attacks. Now, 20 years later, the pullout from Afghanistan and that whole debacle, right? The American kind of downturn from the Middle East and everything changing in that way. Lahav, do you think that Americans get it today? Do we get it? Are we on the same page?
I don't think that Americans get it today. I think that briefly they got it. I think that, you know, George W. Bush, you know, and his administration got it to some extent. You know, and that there was some sympathy at the time. I don't know how long it lasted. I can't put my finger on it. But
well, I mean, we definitely know. Yeah. Even looking at the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice pushed and pushed and pushed, right? Olmert at the time to make peace overtures to Mahmoud Abbas.
Right,
the
Olmert Annapolis was 2006. Conference.
Right. So I'm saying years, you know, a few years pass.
Yeah.
And they're still, you know, in their second term in office,
yeah,
they're pushing hard for a withdrawal from the West Bank.
Right. But I did feel like, and I don't know, correct, I mean, maybe the you guys have a different sense of it, but I did feel like when people talked about the world and the war on terror, that it was like Hamas was in that axis of evil, that Israel was on the sort of right side of war of terror when that terminology was still going on. Of course, you know, the U.S. was like, in this sort of shock for the first couple of years, right, where it was like all about the war on terror. And then around the time of the Iraq war was when it sort of became, I don't even know if politically correct is a word, but it was like there was a more open controversy and debate over like whether we're dealing with this okay. And I think maybe that was also the turning point for how people were looking at Israel. Certainly before 9/11, the way people looked at the Second Intifada and Israel's response to it was super, super negative. I mean, we all know the whole story with Al-Dura and how that was completely misrepresented by the press. And
but I think that people in the West, definitely when you look at certain liberal progressive circles, look at Israel and, you know, they look at terrorism that they face, maybe, and they look at wars in Afghanistan and Yemen and Iraq and the Iranian nuclear threats. But then they look at Israel and the Palestinians or Israel and Hamas and Gaza. And to them, it's a different, it's not the same, right? It's not one and the same.
I agree with that.
There's always been that kind of double standard to an extent. And maybe that's because we just get a double standard. And, or you know, there's also, there's no question, the Israeli control over the West Bank, which people call the occupation, is also part of what that leads to them to saying, well, if you only ended the occupation, things would be different.
Sure. But if you, I mean, if you look at the, like, the terrorists who are attacking America or France or wherever, and the things that they often say is they believe that those countries are, like, imperialists who, you know, and obviously America was not occupying, well, it was Saudi Arabia who sent the terrorists, right? America was not occupying Saudi Arabia, but certainly, like, their reasoning is not so different from the reasoning of the people attacking us, even if the facts of the ground are very different.
Yaakov, though, what do you think Israel has learned from 9/11? Because, yes, it's one thing to say maybe now they will understand us better, but what have we learned from that experience?
That's a great question. I think that, kind of like what we were saying before, of this attempt on the Israeli side to get the world to understand what we're going through, it succeeded for a bit of time, but then that passed. We have yet to really, I think, articulate in a proper, in the most effective way, what is happening here. And that's a consistent failure on our part. I think that we don't fully understand the American mentality still. Just because there's a terrorist attack doesn't mean that America is turning into the way Israel fights terrorism. We also tend to very much still look at the Middle East from our prism. We're not understanding, right, you know, this withdrawal from Afghanistan, right? You have to look at it from American perspective, right? It makes sense for Biden, right? Americans don't have an interest in being there. Now, of course, Israel looks at it as a turn away from the Middle East, something that will reflect poorly on Israel, a weakened America as a weakened Israel. The vacuum will be filled by radical Islamist terrorists, which is, of course, happening with the Taliban. Every vacuum, by the way, in the Middle East, as far as I can tell, has always been filled by radical extremists. So I'd be happy to be proven wrong. But I don't think that we fully get the other side either. And I mean, that's always going to be an issue, right? I think.
I also think the big picture is that, you know, the world isn't black and white, but there is kind of the good and the evil.
Right.
And we are clearly, Israel is clearly on the side of the United States and civilized democratic countries against what we perceive as evil, which is, you know, terrorism from ISIS to Hamas that threatens to destabilize not just the region, but the entire world. And that particular incident 20 years ago changed the world forever, and yeah. The question is, have we internalized the lessons of 9/11?
You know, I think it's interesting also, just if we look at the Middle East more broadly, how a lot of things have changed, because, you know, the terrorists were funded by Saudi Arabia. Mohammed Atta, one of the pilots, hijackers, better word, was Egyptian. And these are people that now Israel considers like allies in fighting terror. And to some extent, so does the U.S. I mean, I just pulled up the name of the book by Dory Gold, the former ambassador to the U.N. He wrote a book about Saudi Arabia in 2003 called Hatred's Kingdom.
Right.
And now he's all about Israel making overtures to try to Correct. Normalize ties with Saudi Arabia.
So the region has changed. The world has right. changed to some extent, Lahav. Right. On the one hand, like you point out, yes, we went from those were the bad guys to now us all being in the same block or axes aligned against Iran and radical Islamic terrorism to an extent, right? But Egypt under Assisi, right, is against the Muslim Brotherhood connected to Hamas. I mean, these are all things that we're interested in, right? On the other hand, though, if you look at this 20-year time span, when America gets hit in 9/11, goes into Afghanistan, takes down the Taliban, and now we're 20 years later and Taliban is back, America is out, and they're more powerful than they were. So the question that you also ask yourself is, okay, so maybe things have realigned in a different way in the Middle East in general, but some things are back the way they once were. And who knows? Maybe on this Rosh Hashanah, we look back and we wonder about the cycle of how things, do they really change, and what impact they do have. Steve, thanks for coming on and sharing with us the events of September 11th here in the Jerusalem Post newsroom.
Thank you.
Closing out this week's Jerusalem Post podcast, I just want to wish all of our listeners a Shana Tova u'Metuka, sweet new year, and a K'tiva v'Chatima Tova, may you all be written in the book of life and good health.